Eddie, the Collegiate Freshman. Copyright 2019 by Dr. Robert E. Z. Chapter 1. School Starts Yet Again, Part 1. Kathy and Paula are now beginning their third year at the university. Barbara is now a senior, and Johnson is a sophomore. Not in school for the last year, Eddie, Mark, Braden, Mitchell, and Bobby B. are all incoming freshmen at the university. Erica, Hoffa, and Akinmola are also part of the freshman class, bringing much of the tribe together again. This year, once again, Eddie and most of the tribe are the new guys on the block. Eddie, Mark, Braden, Mitchell, and Bobby B. have all practiced with the team on many occasions, but they have not yet competed at the collegiate level. Todd McCutcheon, who lives on the university campus with no car, is now a sophomore. Being a sophomore does not make him any faster on the track than he was last year or when he was in high school. Neither does it grant him any seniority on the track team. McCutcheon is still bothered by Eddie's MGB, Kathy's Porsche, Mark's Jeep, and Paula's Jeep. And, with Kathy and Paula now having matching dune buggies, McCutcheon is more miffed than ever. And, as if that wasn't enough, Eddie and Kathy's house in the woods, and Mark and Paula's house in the woods a mile away, really ticks off McCutcheon. But, the tribe and McCutcheon are now on the same team. There have already been a few signs of contention between McCutcheon and the tribe, but, with any luck, they will all get along once the track season starts. Last year, McCutcheon seriously compromised his integrity by running in his brother's place for Centerville High School during the state invitational meet. And, with McCutcheon and Leggett crashing Mark and Paula's wedding last year, getting along with the tribe might be asking a bit too much. A month ago, Mark vowed to pay back McCutcheon and Leggett for their nasty deed. During the first week of classes, early on Wednesday morning, Eddie and the rest of the tribe heads to the track. Practice starts at 7 a.m. sharp, which is when everyone is expected to be dressed and ready to run, not when they stumble into the locker room to change. Since the earliest classes start at 8 a.m., the parking lot is virtually empty when the tribe arrives for practice. Arriving one by one, it's easy for the tribe to find where everyone else is parked. With an empty parking lot, the tribe has just assigned themselves a place where they will all park together in the future. By 6:40 a.m., Eddie's MGB, Kathy's dune buggy, Mark's Jeep, Paula's dune buggy, Bobby B's BSA Starfire motorcycle, Erica's BSA motorcycle, and Mitchell's Opel 1900 are all parked at the end of the parking lot adjacent to the track. Hoffa and Tessa have chosen to live on campus in the dorms. Akinmola, who has dual enrollment status, chose to live at the university simply because track practice starts early in the morning. Braden, who is employed as a campus police officer, has been given a complimentary private dorm suite on campus as part of his package. This benefits both Braden and the university. Braden gets a free place to live, and the university has a backup officer on campus 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Well, almost. All students occasionally leave campus, especially to get a good home-cooked meal or pizza. And Wendy, who has transferred to the university this semester, is Tessa's roommate. The tribe heads to the locker rooms, getting ready for their first practice session of the school year. On the way in, Erica comments, "I think I've been here a few times before." And she has. The university track is where the state invitational meets are held. Erica has won many medals on this track. Kathy tells Erica, "By the way, you're replacing Janice in the 440-yard dash. And you'll probably be on the mile medley relay team with me, Paula, and Barbara." Erica comments, "I wonder if I'll be fast enough." Reassuring Erica, Kathy tells her, "Trust me. You're fast enough. Just run your best." With the team assembled in the arena, the head coach, Dr. Braun, walks in, along with Dr. Paxton, the distance coach, Coach Herndon, the sprinting coach, and Dr. Bonamo, the field events coach. Seeing the coaching team walk in, the team heads over to the bleachers, and everyone takes a seat. The freshmen, who will understand the drill after today, follow the upperclassmen. The tribe all sits together, reminiscent of a few years ago. While they are waiting, Mark sees that McCutcheon is eavesdropping on his conversation with Eddie. Mark whispers to Eddie, "Hey, pretend to get into an argument with me. Say, it's in Italy." Following Mark's instruction, Eddie exclaims, "It's in Italy." Mark replies, "It's not in Italy." Eddie replies, "Yeah, it is. It's in Italy." Mark and Eddie exchange a few words for a minute or so, as McCutcheon seems to be paying even more attention to the makeshift argument. Mark announces, "Maybe McCutcheon will know." Catching his attention, Mark asks McCutcheon, "Hey, are you smart?" McCutcheon replies, "Yeah." Mark asks him, "If a plane crashes on the border of Italy and Switzerland, where do they bury the survivors?" Thinking about it, McCutcheon replies, "They bury them in whatever country they were from." Mark nods his head and replies, "Really?" McCutcheon replies, "Yeah." Overhearing the conversation, Kathy starts laughing and blurts out, "They don't bury survivors. I haven't heard that one since like the third grade." Mark has often compared McCutcheon's performance on the track to that of a middle school student. Today, Mark has reduced McCutcheon's cognitive abilities down to that of a third grader. McCutcheon is saved by the bell. Dr. Braun, the head coach, blows his whistle. Dr. Braun gives a welcome message to the team and introduces the other coaches, informing the athletes of their function with the team. After the opening announcements, Dr. Braun announces, "Today we are running time trials. I want to see exactly where everyone's performance stands. We will all head out to the track, where Mrs. Owens, the events coordinator, is waiting for us outside. She will be compiling and analyzing your times. The distance team will meet with Dr. Paxton, and the sprinters will meet with Coach Herndon. The field athletes will meet with Dr. Bonamo. Okay, let's head outside and give it our best." The team heads out to the track, ready to start the season. Once outside, Coach Herndon, the coach to the sprinters, looks over the field of runners she has to work with this year. McCutcheon proudly stands in front of the group, while Eddie and the tribe all stand in the back. Coach Herndon announces, "Everybody listen up. The 100-yard dash time trials are up first. You must run to the best of your ability today. Everyone warm up, and we'll start in just a moment." Eddie and the tribe stretches and takes a lap around the track to warm up. McCutcheon and Leggett, on the other end of the spectrum, see no real reason to warm up. This is because they are aerobically deficient from slacking off over the summer and are conserving what little energy they have. Once everyone is warmed up, Coach Herndon announces, "Okay. You will run in groups of six. The first heat, get behind the blocks. I'm sorry, ladies. Today, the men are going first. The first heat usually brings the fastest runners." No names were intentionally called because Coach Herndon wants to know who has the guts to step up first. No freshman in their right mind would dare get behind the blocks right now, but that doesn't stop the tribe. As they are lining up, Eddie whispers to Braden, "Take lane one. Trust me." As they get behind the blocks, the tribe pushes McCutcheon over to lane six. Behind the blocks are Eddie, Mark, Braden, Hoffa, Johnson, and McCutcheon. Leggett is wise enough to wait until the second heat. Leggett already knows that all the guys behind the blocks will probably beat him, except for McCutcheon. So, instead of coming in last place, Leggett decided to wait for a heat where he will come in first place. But, as Leggett will quickly find out, you cannot hide from the clock. The tribe exchanges fist bumps, encouraging each other, as they mostly ignore McCutcheon. Mark, the lone holdout, asks McCutcheon, "Hey loser. How was your night in the slammer?" McCutcheon, who spent two nights in jail after crashing Mark and Paula's wedding last summer, has just been put on notice that he is treading on thin ice. Braden exclaims, here we go. The beginning of the ass-kicking season. And I got a bunch of new asses to kick this year. Let's get it going. Kathy is very glad to hear that verbiage once again. Once Coach Herndon is at the finish line, the starter announces, on your marks. The runners get into the blocks, waiting for the signal. The starter announces, set. The starter fires the gun, and five of the six start watchers at the other end of the track begin to record this year's standard of performance in the 100-yard dash. At 25 yards into the race, Eddie is clearly in front. Mark, Braden, and Johnson are right up there with him, with Hoffa holding his own. With his official debut performance, Eddie has something to prove and has been looking forward to this moment all summer. Eddie pushes it harder than he ever thought possible. Halfway through the race, everyone knows exactly what they are witnessing. Knowing that they must deliver the best performance of their career, the tribe pushes each other hard. At the finish line, Eddie takes first place, and Mark takes second place. Third place goes to Braden and Johnson who, as best as can be determined, tied. Hoffa, taking fifth place, delivered a great performance worthy of the scholarship he received. And, as expected, McCutcheon finished in last place, significantly behind the pack. Coach Herndon paces back and forth, anxiously awaiting the report from Mrs. Owens. Receiving each of the runners' times from the timekeepers, Mrs. Owens adds the times to their corresponding performance statistics page. She then does some rudimentary verification, such as making sure the first place runner's time is faster than that of the second place runner. Coach Herndon already knows it was a good run, but, as a spectator without a stopwatch, it is difficult to differentiate a 9.2-second 100-yard dash from a 9.8-second 100-yard dash, especially if the field is close. Finally receiving the report, Coach Herndon screams out, "Everybody listen up. Edward Boganskaya, 9.2 seconds. Mark Svoboda, 9.3 seconds. Axel Braden, 9.5 seconds. Eric Johnson, 9.5 seconds. Jimmy Hoffa, 9.6 seconds. Todd McCutcheon, 11.0 seconds. Did everyone hear that? 9.2 seconds. That's faster than the fastest college time reported last year. And that is an unofficial divisional record. The tribe exchanges high fives and fist bumps. Mark cannot resist commenting to McCutcheon, wow. 11 seconds. You must have been training really hard over the summer. Standing at the finish line, Dr. Braun is quite amazed. At that very moment, he feels justified for the scholarship money he vehemently fought for. Dr. Braun tells Eddie, Mark, Braden, Johnson, and Hoffa, that was an amazing run. Speaking for the entire university, I can say that we are all very, very impressed. Eddie, speaking for the group, replies, thank you. Thank you. Dr. Braun is quite satisfied that he actually got what he paid for, and then some. Dr. Braun is equally as happy that he is not spending any money on McCutcheon, who is not on scholarship. The tribe knows that the 440-yard dash is next. Since this is his event, Braden is getting all psyched up. Before the 440-yard dash, however, a few more heats of the 100-yard dash will be run. The next heat brings the first string women. Kathy, Paula, and Erica are among those behind the blocks. While the women are getting ready, Eddie, pointing to McCutcheon out in the field kicking the grass, mentions to Mark, hey, take a look at that. Deja vu. McCutcheon is kicking the grass like he did back in 8th grade. Mark comments, wow. He's having a nice little temper tantrum. Eddie suggests, maybe that's his way of getting psyched up for the 440-yard dash. Mark responds, let him get psyched up. I'll just psych him back down again. Kathy wins her heat, with Paula taking second place and Erica taking third place. Erica, not used to finishing in third place, is nevertheless very happy with her time. She was up against the gold and silver medal winners in the division for the last 2 years. But Erika's best race is the 440-yard dash. The tribe congratulates Kathy, Paula, and Erika, exchanging high fives, fist bumps, and hugs. Dr. Braun and Coach Herndon, seeing the post-race celebration, are amazed at the level of camaraderie among some of the newer team members. This is something they've not seen in recent years. The time to run the 440-yard dash finally arrives. Walking over to the track, Mark moves in the direction of McCutcheon, who is strolling along with Leggett. Giving McCutcheon some words of encouragement, Mark tells McCutcheon, "Wow. 11 seconds flat in the 100. I ran faster than that in the 6th grade." Trying to give Mark some words of wisdom, Leggett informs Mark, "Hey. Chill out. You guys are on the same team now." Mark emphatically informs McCutcheon and Leggett, "Let's get something straight. If you crash my wedding, we're not on the same team." Mark then tells McCutcheon, "Good luck in the 440. I hope you finish." McCutcheon asks, "Just what is that supposed to mean?" Mark stares at McCutcheon, not elaborating any further, then walks away. As Mark walks away, Leggett tells McCutcheon, "He's just getting us back for crashing his wedding. You heard what he said, something about paybacks." McCutcheon replies, "Yeah. I guess you're right." Leggett assures McCutcheon, "Just ignore him, and he'll stop." If Leggett and McCutcheon believe that Mark's comments are paybacks for crashing his wedding, they are sorely mistaken. The payback will come later. The sprinters get a short break, so they can watch the 1 mile run. Mitchell, Akinmola, and Stone will be fighting it out for the title of the university's fastest distance man. This is Mitchell's and Akinmola's official debut performance with the university team. Watching a race such as this is likely to get the team fired up and motivated, so the 5 minute break is worth it to the coaches. Also of importance, this is one race Coach Herndon does not want to miss herself. The gun is fired and, right off the starting line, Mitchell, Akinmola, and Stone give the distinct impression that they are running the 440-yard dash. After 100 yards, Stone assumes the lead. Mitchell drops in right behind Stone. Right on Stone's heels, Mitchell is gauging the leader's pace. Akinmola, who has not run against Mitchell in a year, clearly notices the faster pace. For the first 440 yards, Mitchell drafts off of Stone, with his legs perfectly synced to the leader. Mitchell is following Stone so closely that, if Stone would suddenly change his stride, they would both likely go down. During the end of the second lap, Mitchell sprints ahead of Stone. Mitchell, using the reserve he acquired by drafting off of Stone, waited until he felt he could take a significant lead. This move was intentional on Mitchell's part, preventing Stone from drafting off of him. Mitchell, who is doing his best to stay a few yards ahead of Stone, is having a very good run. Akinmola, surprisingly, is now right behind Stone. During the third lap, Mitchell is gaining over Stone, albeit slowly. Entering the final lap, someone will win this race, and none of the front runners will be accepting of losing. Akinmola, not used to being in third place, is chasing down Stone, but losing ground. To complicate Stone's strategy, Stone does not know whether he is having a bad run or Mitchell is having an exceptionally good run. With more than just a time trial at stake, each of the three front runners is out to prove a point. As the runners come out of the final curve and approach the finish line, all eyes are on the three distance stars battling it out for the title of the university's best distance man. At the finish line, Mitchell crosses first. Stone crosses second, roughly 4 seconds behind Mitchell. Finishing in third place is Akinmola, crossing the finish line about 5 seconds after Stone. While everyone is waiting for the times to be compiled, Mark comments, "Well, at least they are all still alive. That race looked like it was a killer." Eddie comments in return, "I don't know. Akinmola looks a little rough. Mark replies, "Yeah, I see that. Well, they all look a little rough if you ask me." Paula, offering her words of wisdom, informs them, "They are all fine. Just look at them. They are all lying on the ground ready to take a nap." Kathy asks Paula, "Hey, is that what you think about me when I lay on the ground to catch my breath?" Paula replies, "Every time." Kathy starts chasing Paula, running in circles, just like they have many times before. Kathy's short-lived pursuit of Paula is interrupted by Dr. Paxton, who prepares to make the long-awaited announcement. The words from Dr. Paxton, heard by all, are Mitchell, 356.2. Stone, 359.9. Akinmola, 405.0. Great job, guys. Great job. As Dr. Paxton announces the rest of the times, Akinmola asks, "What did I just hear?" 4 minutes and 5 seconds. Did I hear my time right? One of the runners assures Akinmola, "That's what he said." Akinmola, although he came in third place, is ecstatic because he just beat his previous personal best by about 5 seconds. But in this race, Mitchell takes the prize. Beating Stone by 3.7 seconds, or roughly 35 yards, Mitchell is convinced that Ed is training sled, which he and Akinmola have been using over the latter half of the summer, has been a big help. But Mitchell is also aware that strategy played an important part in the race today. Closely drafting off of Stone for more than a quarter of a mile conserved a lot of energy, preserving more energy for the latter part of the race. Mitchell also knows that he would have run a faster race if Stone were faster. This is because, for 2 laps, Mitchell kept pace with Stone, but knows he could have run slightly faster. Now that the 1 mile run has been completed, Coach Herndon announces to the sprinters, "You will now run the 440-yard dash. You will run with the same group that you ran within the 100-yard dash. And you will take the same lanes." Coach Herndon's decision to keep everyone in the same group and lanes is purely to keep the record keeping easier for Mrs. Owens. Coach Herndon announces, "Okay. The first heat, get behind the blocks." Braden takes lane 1, courtesy of Eddie's earlier recommendation, and looks over at Eddie and smiles. Braden just figured out that Eddie knew in advance that whoever was in lane 1 during the 100-yard dash will also get lane 1 in the 440-yard dash. With his first official appearance in the 440-yard dash, Braden exclaims, "Here we go. Here comes the ass-kicking of the day. Everybody, get out of my way. The chief ass-kicker is back. Back on the track, and ready to attack." Braden, pulling up his shirt as he is dancing around, exclaims, "Back on the track, and showing off my six-pack." Braden then points to McCutcheon and exclaims, "Back on the track, and cutting you no slack." The tribe very much enjoys listening to Braden's rants. So does Coach Herndon and Dr. Braun, who are quite amused at Braden's pre-race performance. McCutcheon and Leggett, however, are not exactly amused. The starter announces, "On your marks." Mark looks over at McCutcheon and yells out, "Go." McCutcheon leaves the blocks, incurring a false start. The tribe laughs at McCutcheon and, surprisingly, Coach Herndon even laughs herself. Braden exclaims, "The race ain't even started, and that's one ass kicked already. And now I get to kick it a second time." Coach Herndon yells out, "McCutcheon, did you hear a gun?" "I didn't. Now, let's try this again." The starter announces, "On your marks," quickly followed by, "Set." The gun is fired, and Braden is out of the blocks, kicking ass as he promised. As the guys set out to break the world record in the 440-yard dash, Kathy tells Paula, "See that? Braden's back, and just look at how different everything is. And did you hear that? He's been practicing his rants." Paula replies, "Yeah. I can definitely see that. That was a really good one, choreographed and all." Halfway through the race, Kathy exclaims, "Wow. Check it out, Eddie, Mark, and Braden are all nearly tied. Paula adds, and Johnson and Hoffa are doing pretty good themselves. As they come out of the final curve, Kathy grabs Paula, telling her, "Come on, girl, we got to see this." Kathy pulls Paula closer to the finish line, positioned for a perfect view of the finish. Kathy and Paula watch intently as the runners rapidly approach. In the sprint to the finish, McCutcheon, far behind the pack, crashes to the ground, but no one immediately pays him any attention. The finish is far more important at the moment. At the line, Braden finishes right alongside of Eddie, with Mark only one or two steps behind. Johnson finishes behind Mark, with Hoffa following Johnson. McCutcheon gets up and walks slowly to the finish line. Waiting for the times to be compiled, Coach Herndon paces back and forth, nervously waiting for the results. After Mark walks off his run, he hears from Paula that McCutcheon went down on the track. Mark jogs over to the timekeeper assigned to lane 6 and asks her, "Is your watch still running?" The timekeeper replies, "Yeah." Mark tells the timekeeper, "Do me a really big favor and catch his time." The timekeeper grins and tells Mark, "Sure thing." The timekeeper is certain that Mark is up to something. Presented with the results, Coach Herndon wants everyone to hear the times. With everyone gathered around, Coach Herndon announces, "Axel Braden and Edward Bogensky are tied, with a time of 45.4 seconds. Mark Svoboda, 45.6 seconds. Eric Johnson, 46.8 seconds. Jimmy Hoffa, 48.5 seconds. Todd McCutcheon, DNF, which stands for did not finish." Correcting Coach Herndon, Mark, who got McCutcheon's time from the timekeeper, announces he finished. It was 3 minutes and 18 seconds. Everyone laughs at Mark's comment, except for McCutcheon and a few of his buddies. Coach Herndon is beginning to understand the interesting dynamics among some of the team members. But, with her military background, she purposely allows it to continue. Mark's comment clearly annoyed McCutcheon. During the next heat, McCutcheon walks over to Mark and angrily asks him, "Hey, what's your problem, anyway?" Mark tells McCutcheon, "Hey, it's you that has the problem, not me. When you got bit by the prickly spider, I told you that it will make your tendons rot away. It's starting. Your body's starting to fall apart." McCutcheon tells Mark, "That's a bunch of bull." Mark replies, "Oh, really? You're the one that went down on the track, not me. And, by the way, you'd better stay off Eddie's training sled. Using it really stresses your tendons. And, just look at what happened. You've been using it, and you went down. That's because all your tendons are falling apart. I told you. Prickly spiders are really bad news." Mark walks away, instilling great fear into McCutcheon's highly programmable mind. Mark meets up with the rest of the tribe, joining them as the remainder of the heats are run. Referring to Mark's discussion with McCutcheon, Eddie asks Mark, "What was that all about?" Mark replies, "I told him his tendons are all rotting away from the prickly spider bite he got a few years ago." Eddie asks, "Did he believe it?" With great confidence, Mark answers, "If he didn't, he will. And it will make him fall down again. And now, his times are going to go down the toilet." Eddie comments, "Jimmy O'Brien might have beat him in that race." After practice, everyone heads to the locker room. The conversation revolves around how good the team might be this year, and that a few good wins might be in the team's future. Eddie asks Mark, "So, what are you up to for the rest of the day?" Mark replies, "I really want to finish the landscaping around the pool." Eddie inquires, "What are you guys doing around your pool?" Mark replies, "I'm putting in a 6-inch layer of pea gravel on the backside. It will keep the weeds down. Nothing is ever going to grow through that." McCutcheon, still green with envy at Eddie's and Mark's apparent financial success, walks by slowly, eavesdropping on Eddie and Mark's conversation. As McCutcheon walks by, he intentionally drops his shampoo bottle, as to delay the trip back to his locker. Mark notices how slow McCutcheon is to pick up the bottle. Delaying the trip to his locker even further, McCutcheon pretends to not be able to find his locker. Eddie and Mark finish their conversation, pretending as if McCutcheon does not exist. On his way home, Mark runs a few errands. With Paula in classes, running errands, such as grocery shopping, are on Mark's list of things to do. Once he arrives home, he spends the rest of the morning completing the landscaping around the pool. Mark then gets a shower and makes his lunch. While Mark is eating, Paula comes home. Mark tells Paula, "Wow, you're home early." Paula lets Mark know, "This semester, on Wednesdays, I get out of class early. I'm done for the day." Mark replies, "Good. Maybe we can go in our pool." Paula makes her lunch and joins Mark. After lunch, Mark gets a few of the items he bought at the store. As Mark is pouring some shampoo down the drain, Paula asks, "What are you doing?" Mark explains, "I'm making a present for McCutcheon." Repeating what Mark said, Paula says, "You're making a present for McCutcheon? Really? This has got to be good. Out with it." Showing Paula the bottle of shampoo, Mark replies, "So, this is McCrutchen's brand of shampoo." Showing Paula the other bottle, Mark explains, "And this bottle is hair remover gel for women's legs. I'm going to mix them together in the shampoo bottle. Then, when McCrutchen is not watching, I'm going to swap shampoo bottles with him." Paula laughs hysterically and exclaims, "You're so good. I can't wait." Mark tells Paula, "His hair is going to slowly fall out." Still laughing, Paula adds, "It serves that jerk right for crashing our wedding." Paula, fully on board with Mark's plan, steps in and helps Mark with his project. Early during the autumn semester of high school, tryouts for the autumn sports begin. Everyone trying out for a team heads to the locker rooms after school. The upperclassmen know the drill, but the freshmen, as usual, are totally lost. As instituted last year, track practice will be held 3 days a week during the autumn. Kathy, Paula, and Barbara will be working with the track athletes during the autumn, each working 1 day a week. Eddie and Mark will be primarily working with the field athletes until winter, when they will start working with the track athletes as well. Kathy and Eddie will be working together on the same days, as will Paula and Mark. Since it is the first meeting of the year, all the team assistants are present. Mr. Fraser, Mr. Chubin, along with the team assistants, all walk into the auxiliary gym where the athletes are already waiting. With a lot of new faces this year, Mr. Fraser's team assistants from the university don't recognize many of the high school students. After sorting out the athletes, Mr. Chubin, the cross-country coach, takes the cross-country team out for a training run. The track team members who are not on the cross-country team remain in the gym. This year, two of the familiar faces are George Livingston and Tom Davidson, who are also on the cross-country team. They just left with Mr. Chubin, along with Amber Amy, who are all running distance for the track team. John Bogenskaya, Paul Davida, and John Elliott are the school's star sprinters this year. And then there's Lucius Hill, who competently runs any race from a short sprint to the 1 mile run. Eric Blankenship, a utility runner who can be expected to place in just about any race, is also returning this year. Mr. Fraser takes the floor and, after his introductory message to the team, announces, "This year, we are again working out 3 days a week during the autumn." Mr. Fraser then instructs the athletes, "If you are a distance runner, Barbara will be your coach today." Barbara identifies herself by waving to the athletes on the bleachers. Mr. Fraser then instructs the athletes, "If you are a sprinter, Kathy and Paula will be your coach." Kathy and Paula wave to the athletes, identifying themselves. Mr. Fraser continues, "If you are a field athlete, Eddie and Mark will be working with you today, and for the rest of the semester." They will also be working with the sprinters on occasion. Eddie and Mark both wave to the athletes, many of which already know who they are. Mr. Fraser then instructs everyone to head out to the track. On the way to the track, Mr. Fraser instructs Barbara to have the distance athletes run a mile for time after everyone takes a warm-up lap. And, for the sprinters, Mr. Fraser asks Kathy and Paula to time everyone in the 100-yard dash. This will give Mr. Fraser a good indication of what he has to work with this year. With a few months of practice before the season begins, there is no reason for Mr. Fraser to rush. Out on the track, the runners all take a warm-up lap. Mr. Fraser, Eddie, and Mark gather the field equipment from the storage building. While they are moving the equipment, Eddie tells Mr. Fraser, "I built something for you over the summer." Mr. Fraser asks, "Oh yeah. What's that?" Eddie replies, "It's a variation of my training sled that can be used on a gravel track. I tried it a few times, and I think I have it just right. It's in my trunk. Let me go and get it." Mr. Fraser tells Eddie, "I'd love to see it." Eddie walks over and asks Kathy for the keys to her dune buggy. Driving the dune buggy, Eddie can more easily deliver the sled and its four associated 25-pound weight plates to the track. And Kathy's dune buggy drives a bit better off-road than Eddie's MGB. Eddie loads the training sled into the dune buggy and drives through the service entrance to the schoolyard. While Eddie unloads the training sled along with the four 25-pound weight plates, Mr. Fraser and a few of the athletes come over and check out Kathy's dune buggy. Everywhere Kathy's dune buggy goes, it seems to attract a lot of attention. Once everyone has had a good look, Eddie returns the dune buggy to the parking lot and returns to the track. As the sprinters are doing their time trials in the 100-yard dash, and the distance runners are running a mile for time, Eddie shows Mr. Fraser the training sled and demonstrates its use. The newer version, designed to be used on a gravel track, provides resistance through its numerous cross members rather than vertical components that dig into the sand. Mr. Fraser, fully understanding the concept of resistance training, decides to give it a try himself. Running up the track wearing the harness, it becomes very clear to the seasoned coach why Eddie is so fast. Mr. Fraser turns around, dragging the sled back to where he started. Mr. Fraser exclaims, "This is awesome. I know exactly what the team will be doing today." Eddie is very happy that Mr. Fraser is satisfied with the new training sled. Eddie tells Mr. Fraser, "Hey, it looks like the sled even smoothed out the gravel on the track. It's kind of like a Zamboni, but for the track." Mr. Fraser comments, "Yeah. I can see that. This track is going to be looking really good in an hour." Once the time trials are completed, Mr. Fraser calls the team over and has a few of the runners give the training sled a try. John, who has his own training sled, which is built for the sand, is the first to give it a try. One by one, the runners get their chance to experience one of the ways in which Eddie became the fastest high school sprinter in the nation. After a few of the runners have given the training sled a try, Mr. Fraser glances toward the school. Seeing Mr. Crum headed out to the track, Mr. Fraser comments to Eddie and Mark, "I wonder what he wants this early in the year." Eddie tells Mr. Fraser, "Maybe he wants to try the training sled." Mr. Fraser laughs and responds, "I'll be glad to put that harness on him. Does anyone have a whip?" Eddie laughs and is glad to hear some humor in the situation. Since he now reports to Mr. Zunday, Mr. Fraser has become much less tolerant of Mr. Crum. Near the finish line, Kathy mentions to Paula, "Here comes that old Crum again. I wonder what he wants this time." Paula replies, "He probably wants to suspend someone for cutting in the lunch line." Seeing trouble headed their way, Kathy and Paula, who are working with some of the sprinters, come over and join Mr. Fraser and the other team assistants. They figure there's more safety in numbers. Mr. Crum, as he is walking up, yells out from 20 yards away, "Who drove that yellow thing into the schoolyard?" Mr. Fraser ignores Mr. Crumb as he waits for the runner currently using the training sled to return to the starting location. Kathy, remembering the incident from last year, steps onto the track and blows her whistle, acting like a traffic cop. Blowing her whistle again, Kathy yells out, "Everyone, please stop." Thule approaching the track. Code red. This is not a drill. Code red. This is not a drill. Everyone, stop. Kathy, again blowing her whistle, announces, "Thule approaching at 90 degrees, 10 yards out, closing in at 1 foot per second. Red alert." Mr. Fraser turns around and laughs hysterically, asking Eddie, "How does she come up with this stuff?" Eddie laughs and replies, "I don't know. That one surprised me too." Paula tells Mark, "This one is not going to end well. I can feel it." Mr. Fraser tells his assistants, "Well, here he comes. Let's see what his problem is this time." Mr. Crumb approaches Mr. Fraser and his team assistants and asks, "Who drove that yellow thing into the schoolyard?" Eddie sarcastically replies, "Yellow thing? Thing? Really, Crumb?" Eddie clearly is ticked off at Mr. Crumb calling Kathy's June buggy a thing. Mr. Crumb exclaims, "Yes. That's what I said." Eddie informs Mr. Crumb, "There are yellow vehicles that could have been driven into the schoolyard, but not things." Attempting to circumvent any confrontation, Mr. Fraser tells Mr. Crumb, "Just get out of here already. You're going nowhere with this, and you know it." Mr. Crumb, in a demanding tone, tells Mr. Fraser, "I demand to know who drove that yellow vehicle, as Eddie put it, into the schoolyard." Mr. Fraser tells Mr. Crumb, "Eddie did, and I allowed it." "So what? Now, just leave. Go back to your office and push your pencil around." Ignoring Mr. Fraser's advice, Mr. Crumb asks Eddie, "So, you drove that thing into the schoolyard?" Eddie replies, "No. I didn't drive that thing into the schoolyard. I drove a high-precision, custom-built, high-performance dune buggy into the schoolyard. And, for your information, you pepper-seat ahead, the dune buggy is street-legal." John tells Amber and Elliot, "Oh, man. Eddie is really ticked off now." Amber asks, "How can you tell?" John replies, "He just called Mr. Crumb a pepper-seat ahead." Amber asks, "What's a pepper-seat ahead?" John explains, "No one is allowed to curse or use bad words in our home. So, Eddie made up pepper-seat ahead a long time ago. Calling someone a pepper-seat ahead is worse than all the four-letter expletives you can ever think of. Nothing is worse than being called a pepper-seat ahead." Amber comments, "I'll have to remember that. Pepper-seat ahead. Yeah, that's a good one." Mr. Fraser tells Mr. Crumb, "Crumb, get out of here. As I said, you're not going anywhere with this, and you know it." Mr. Crumb, ignoring Mr. Fraser, angrily yells at Eddie, asking, "What did you call me?" Kathy tells Eddie, "Just ignore the pepper-seat ahead." Eddie replies, "Yeah, seriously. I'm getting back to the drill. I don't have time for his shit." Eddie turns around and walks back to the starting line where the training sled is. Mark follows Eddie as they both intend to continue the training exercises. An irate Mr. Crumb yells out to Eddie, "You. I'm talking to you. Get back here." Eddie ignores Mr. Crumb, but Mr. Crumb follows Eddie and Mark to the starting line. Mr. Crumb, who is now extremely angry, runs up behind Eddie and places Eddie into a chokehold. Eddie quickly grabs Mr. Crumb by the neck and flips him over his shoulder, slamming his body to the ground with an enormous amount of force. Great silence comes over the team as they all witness the incident. Laying on the ground, gasping for air, Mr. Crumb seriously wonders whether he will live or not. Kathy runs over to Eddie, asking him, "Sweetie, are you okay?" Eddie replies, "Yeah. I'm just sick of that piece of shit laying on the ground." The team gathers around, watching the principal flail on the ground. One athlete comments, "Look at him. It looks like he's dying." Mr. Fraser tells everyone, "He's okay. He just got the wind knocked out of him." Mr. Fraser tells Mr. Crumb, "Crumb, get up. You're acting like a little pussy." Beginning to catch his breath, Mr. Crumb says, I think he broke my backbone. I think he broke it." Eddie is quick to reply, "Crumb, you have no backbone. You're nothing but a jellyfish. Get up and get your ass out of here." 5 minutes after being slammed to the ground, Mr. Crumb is finally able to stand up. Mr. Crumb, in obvious pain, tells Eddie, "You're not getting away with this." Eddie replies, "And neither are you. The next time you attack me, you won't be so lucky." Eddie then sternly looks at Mr. Crumb and exclaims, "Pepper seed ahead." As Mr. Crumb hobbles back to the school, Mr. Fraser announces, "Okay, everyone back to the workout." As Mr. Crumb heads back to the school, the team gets back to their workout. All the sprinters get a few chances to use the training sled, and the gravel on the track is now in pristine condition. Barbara returns with the distance team, who were out on a long training run. A few of the distance team members try the training sled and are assured that, during the next workout, they will get their chance to use it. Just as all of the day's excitement is about to wind down, Mr. Crumb is headed out to the track again, this time accompanied by two police officers. Kathy exclaims, "Shit! Here comes more trouble." Mr. Fraser, seeing Mr. Crumb approaching, announces to the team, "That guy just does not know when to quit. I'll take care of this." Everyone waits in anticipation to see what Mr. Crumb has up his sleeve this time. Mr. Crumb and the officers approach Mr. Fraser. The senior officer, Officer Richard Hayes, who knows Eddie well, tells Mr. Fraser, "I understand from Mr. Crumb that there was an altercation out here on the field earlier today." Mr. Fraser, sounding a bit like Braden, replies, "There certainly was. It was a pretty good ass kicking if you ask me. You really should have been here to see it. I'm sorry you missed it." Eddie and Kathy look at each other, quite surprised at how Mr. Fraser answered the officer. Mark looks at Paula and, hearing Mr. Fraser's response, grins. Officer Hayes tells Mr. Fraser, "Tell me what happened out here." Pointing to Mr. Crumb, Mr. Fraser responds, "Mr. Crumb, the principal, put Eddie, who is one of my team assistants, into a choke hold." Mr. Crumb exclaims, "I did not." The whole team replies to the effect, "Yeah, you did. We all saw it." Taking advantage of the team's participation in the questioning, Mr. Fraser adds, "All of the sprinters saw it when it happened. The distance team was out on a training run." Mr. Fraser continues, "So, as I was saying, Mr. Crumb put Eddie into a choke hold, and Eddie body slammed him to the ground." Already having Mr. Crumb's private statement, Officer Hayes calls Eddie aside to get his statement. Officer Hayes asks Eddie, "Tell me what happened." Eddie, pointing to the training sled, replies, "I built a training sled for the track team. Since it weighs 25 pounds, and I had 4 25-pound weight plates to bring to the track, I drove Kathy's dune buggy through the service entrance to drop it off. 15 minutes later, Crumb comes out and starts ranting that I drove into the schoolyard. I ignored him and went back to my training drill with Mark and the runners. He came up from behind and put me in a choke hold. So, I body slammed him to the ground." Officer Hayes, who already has the situation figured out, calls Mr. Crumb and Mr. Fraser over. The officer asks Eddie and Mr. Crumb, "Okay, which one of you started the altercation?" Eddie boldly replies, "Crumb did." Mr. Crumb yells out, "I did not. He started it." Mr. Fraser tells Officer Hayes, "Everyone saw it. Mr. Crumb started it by putting Eddie into a choke hold." Officer Hayes then elaborates, "Okay. Let me ask the question this way. Who touched who first?" Eddie describes to Officer Hayes, Crum put his arm around the front of my neck first. Officer Hayes asks Mr. Crum, "Is that true?" Mr. Crum replies, "Well, yes. But he called me a name." Officer Hayes asks Eddie, "What did you call him?" Eddie replies, "I called him a pepper-seeder head. Then I walked away." Officer Hayes then asks Eddie, "And after he put you in a chokehold, is that when you body slammed him?" Eddie replies, "Yeah." Standing in front of Mr. Crum, Eddie, and Mr. Fraser, with the rest of the team watching, Officer Hayes summarizes, "So, let me get this straight. Eddie called Mr. Crum a pepper-seeder head. Mr. Crum then puts Eddie into a chokehold. Eddie then body slams Mr. Crum into the ground. Am I correct?" Eddie replies, "Yes." Sternly looking at Mr. Crum, Officer Hayes asks, "Am I correct?" Mr. Crum reluctantly replies, "Yes. But he started it." Calling Mr. Crum, Eddie, and Mr. Fraser aside, Officer Hayes explains, "There is no law against calling someone a pepper-seeder head, whatever that is. There is, however, a law against putting someone in a chokehold. It's called assault. Any subsequent action taken by the person assaulted is called justifiable self-defense." Addressing Mr. Crum directly, Officer Hayes explains, "Putting Eddie in a chokehold was not the best decision you could have made. If he wanted to, Eddie could have you arrested." Hearing the bad news, Mr. Crum yells out, "But he started it." Officer Hayes tells Mr. Crum, "Let me put it to you this way. If Johnny calls Billy stupid, and Billy beats up Johnny, in your book, who started the fight?" Mr. Crum is silenced. Officer Hayes continues, "So, as I was saying, Eddie could have you arrested." Addressing Eddie, Officer Hayes asks, "Do you want to press charges and have Maurice Crum arrested?" Eddie asks, "Can I decide tomorrow?" Officer Hayes informs Eddie, "Yes. The statute of limitations in this state is 2 years. You have 2 years to decide whether you want to press charges." Eddie informs the officer, "I don't want to decide right now. I'll have to think about this." Mr. Crum is relieved to a slight degree, but knows that he is still in hot water. Officer Hayes tells Eddie and Mr. Crum, "I'm going to file my report. If there are any other questions, here's my card with your case number written on it." Having enough of Mr. Crum already this school year, Officer Hayes hands Eddie and Mr. Crum his card. Before he leaves, Officer Hayes privately talks with Eddie. Unknown to Mr. Crum, since Eddie has been working at Angelo's service station, he has a good working relationship with Officer Hayes. Officer Hayes tells Eddie, "I really don't know what's wrong with that character. This is not the first time I've been out here this year, and school just started." Eddie replies, "He was definitely out of control. I tried to ignore him, and I think that's what really set him off. He was kind of acting like Paul Mahoney, or the Chucky, when they were on drugs. And he lives on Second Street. Kathy and Paula think Second Street is haunted." Quite startled, Officer Hayes replies, "Really? Mr. Crum lives on Second Street? How do you know that?" Eddie explains, "We found out from Mr. Zunday once. Mr. Zunday said that Mr. Crum bought a house on Second Street, thinking the area would go commercial, but it never did." Without realizing it, Eddie just gave Officer Hayes some potentially valuable information. Officer Hayes heads out, and Eddie calls it a day. Once Officer Hayes is gone, Eddie tells Mr. Crum, "Tomorrow, at 2:30 p.m., I will be at your office. I suggest you make the time to meet with me. Otherwise, I will have you arrested. Got it?" Mr. Crum replies, "Yeah, yeah. I'll be there." Eddie firmly replies, "You'd better be there." Mr. Crum heads back to the school, wishing now that he'd never called the police. Once Mr. Crum is gone, Eddie asks Mr. Fraser, "Hey, can you and Mr. Zunday be there too?" Mr. Fraser replies, "I wouldn't miss it for the world." Wanting to be clear, Mr. Fraser asks, "You said 2:30, right?" Eddie replies, "Yeah." Mr. Fraser assures Eddie, "We'll be there." The next day, after work, Eddie heads to the high school for his scheduled meeting with Mr. Crum. Walking into the administration area, Eddie sees that Mr. Fraser and Mr. Zunde are already waiting outside Mr. Crum's office. Eddie says hello to Mr. Zunde, who already found out about yesterday's altercation from Mr. Fraser. Eddie asks Mrs. Marlowe, the school secretary, "Is Crum ready?" Mrs. Marlowe replies, "He's been nervously waiting all day. He doesn't look too good." Using the intercom, Mrs. Marlowe tells Mr. Crum that Eddie is waiting. Mr. Crum opens his door and invites Eddie in. Seeing Mr. Fraser and Mr. Zunde, Mr. Crum asks, "Why are these two here?" Eddie rebukes Mr. Crum, telling him, "Really, Crum? These two? That sounds a bit disrespectful, don't you think?" Eddie then bluntly informs Mr. Crum, "If you remember correctly, this is my meeting. I invited them. If you prefer, we can hold the meeting in the auxiliary gym." Mr. Crum, forgetting that he is not the chairman of today's meeting, tells Mr. Fraser and Mr. Zunde, "Okay, everybody please come in." Mr. Fraser is shocked to hear Mr. Crum use the word "please." Eddie takes a seat, while Mr. Fraser and Mr. Zunde assume their normal position in front of the bookcase, near the door. Eddie opens the meeting by telling Mr. Crum, "Wow. You still haven't got a new desk. What's up with that?" Mr. Crum sarcastically replies, "And the bookshelf hasn't been replaced either." Eddie comments, "Wow. I hear from John that the furniture I broke in the library has already been replaced. I wonder how they got ahead of you on the list." Eddie puts his greasy shoes up on Mr. Crum's desk and tells him, "Let's get down to business. If you heard what the officer said yesterday, I could have you arrested." Mr. Crum brashly responds, "I don't think we have to go to that extreme." Eddie calmly replies, "Crum, I really don't care what you think. I invited you to this meeting so you can hear what I think. And, for the record, what you think doesn't matter to me at all. So, get your pencil and start pushing it around on your pad of paper." Mr. Zunde whispers to Mr. Fraser, "I can't wait to hear this." Mr. Fraser whispers back, "I don't know what Eddie is going to say, but this is going to be good." Mr. Zunde and Mr. Fraser stand with their arms crossed as Eddie prepares to figuratively kick Mr. Crum's ass. The literal ass kicking was yesterday. Eddie continues, "First of all, I'm not too appreciative of you attacking me. And, for the record, if you ever attack me again, you will resemble the Chucky after I kicked the shit out of him. So, write that down so you never forget it. But, that's not why I'm here." Mr. Crum angrily replies, "So, get to the point, already." Eddie tells Mr. Crum, "And stop acting like a conceited little asshole. I had to listen to your shit for 4 years. Now, it's your turn to shut up and listen, and start taking notes." Eddie has all the cards, and he clearly knows it. Eddie continues, telling Mr. Crum, "The good news is that I am not having you arrested right now. However, if you heard the officer yesterday, I have 2 years to make that decision. So, here's the deal, Junior. If you interfere with the track team in any way, I'm having you arrested, plain and simple. So, keep your ass out of the way, and stay inside and push your pencil around. Am I clear?" Mr. Crum, changing his tune, replies, "Sure. I can do that." Eddie, however, is not entirely convinced that Mr. Crum is being sincere. Not playing any games, Eddie tells Mr. Crum, "Say it. Say you'll stay out of the way of the track team. Say it." Unwillingly, Mr. Crum repeats, "Okay, okay, I'll stay out of the way of the track team." Eddie then turns to Mr. Fraser and Mr. Zunde and asks, "And you heard him say it, right?" Mr. Fraser replies, "I did. And it was like music to my ears." Mr. Zunde replies, "I heard it. And I fully expect him to be true to his word." Eddie tells Mr. Crum, "I hope you wrote it down, so you can remind yourself every day. And you'd better not screw up, otherwise I'll have you arrested. Eddie tells Mr. Crum, well, then we're done with this meeting. That's all I wanted. Pointing to Mr. Crum, Eddie instructs him, and remember, if you screw up, I'm having you arrested. Eddie walks out of Mr. Crum's office. Mr. Fraser and Mr. Zunday, not wanting to spend any additional time with Mr. Crum, quickly follow. Eddie, along with Mr. Fraser and Mr. Zunday, head to the physical education office for a moment. Mr. Fraser tells Eddie, that was brilliant. You backed him into a corner and gave him only one choice. Eddie comments, he'll stay out of the way for a while, but I'm sure he'll forget soon enough. Mr. Zunday adds, we'll just remind him that he could be arrested should he get out of line. That should keep him at bay for a while. Eddie, Mr. Fraser, and Mr. Zunday exchange fist bumps, hopeful that Mr. Crum will stay off the track team's back for a while. Eddie then heads home to clean up from work, and will be back for track practice shortly, along with Kathy.